To make a donation, visit biblicallycorrectpodcast.org/donate. And if you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, and subscribe. Thank you for your support. Will you endure and persevere in your faith? Welcome to the Biblically Correct Podcast. Shalom, y'all. This is the Biblically Correct Podcast, teaching biblical correctness in a biblically incorrect world. My name is Kevin Jeffrey. I'm a Jewish follower of the Messiah Yeshua, Jesus, and I love teaching the scriptures. Will you endure and persevere in your faith in Yeshua? Though we still have one more chapter after this, Hebrews 12 brings the author's main message, his exhortation to persevere in the faith of the Messiah Yeshua, to its final conclusion. Having wrapped up his case in the previous chapter for believing in and holding fast to the Master, the author taught us that faith is a confidence of things hoped for, a conviction regarding matters not seen. He then proceeded to walk us through the so-called Hall of Faith, an extensive list of examples from Israel's history of those exhibiting superb, patient, enduring faith in God. And he did this to draw attention to their collective testimony of faith that since these remained faithful, despite not having received the promise of their faith, then we can most certainly continue to persevere in ours. Because as followers of Messiah, God has provided something better for us, a son better than the angels, a better hope, a better covenant, a better sacrifice, a better homeland, and better promises in the Master Yeshua. And it's in light of this abundant testimony of faith, this great cloud of witnesses, that the author begins both chapter 12 and the serious and sobering end of his message. Starting in verses 1 and 2, he offers this admonition. Therefore, since we also are having so great a cloud of witnesses set around us, having put off every weight and the closely surrounding sin, through perseverance, let us run the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on the author and perfecter of faith, Yeshua, who, over against the joy set before him, endured an execution stake, and, having despised the shame, also sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So the author begins verse 1 by referring back to the rich and abounding faith of the great cloud of witnesses of chapter 11. And since we have their testimony, we're now supposed to add that to our own, by which we, as believers in Yeshua, because of our faith in him, should have already put off every weight and the closely surrounding sin. Our faith in Yeshua should cause us to put off the weight of our old selves, to lay aside the actions of darkness, to cast our cares upon him, and to throw off the sin that accompanies those burdens. So by adding the testimony of the witnesses of faith to our own faith and trust in Messiah, the author exhorts us now to act through perseverance. As he's been telling us for the last 11 chapters, now is not the time to fall away through unbelief, but to believe even harder, to endure whatever comes next, to keep up our strength, to push through and persevere like a runner running his race. And just as a runner has it on his heart and mind to win that race, to cross the finish line with the best speed and strength, the author encourages us in verse 2 to fix our eyes on the author and perfecter of faith, Yeshua. Just as a runner can't complete his race unless he knows where he's going, we also can't finish ours unless we're running in the right direction, toward our one and only goal, Yeshua. Yeshua alone is the one who writes our faith upon our hearts, and he perfects that faith through his perfect mediation and sacrifice. So we fix our eyes on him in order to not be distracted by what's behind us, or in our peripheral view. No matter what's bombarding us from the side or chasing us from behind, we're to fix our eyes on Yeshua and run toward him with all perseverance. Because as the author points out, not only do we have a great cloud of witnesses, and not only have we put off every weight of the closely surrounding sin, but we also have the actions and testimony of the Master Yeshua himself, who, over against the joy set before him, seeing the joy that was ahead, endured an execution stake, and, having despised the shame, also sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Yeshua ran his race of endurance first for us, so that we would have a path to follow him with our own faith and perseverance. So if Yeshua could endure all that he did so that we could live, surely we can run after him and endure the difficulties and challenges of our lives. It's Yeshua's example, then, that the author goes on in his exhortation to hold up before us as a model of perseverance. In verses 3 through 6, he continues, "For consider again him who endured such opposition from the sinners to himself, so that you may not be wearied in your souls, giving up. You did not yet resist to the point of shedding your blood in your struggling with the sin. And you have forgotten the exhortation that speaks fully with you as sons. My son, be not despising the discipline of Adonai, nor giving up, being rebuked by him. For whom Adonai loves, he disciplines, and he punishes every son whom he receives." So the author says in verse 3 to consider again him who endured such opposition from the sinners to himself, meaning Yeshua, as well as all the people who contributed to and caused his execution. And the author says to consider how Yeshua endured all this opposition so that we won't be wearied in our souls and give up. He wants us to be inspired by Yeshua's endurance and sacrifice so that we won't come to the point within ourselves of giving up on the faith. Then the author points out to his readers in verse 4 that compared to Yeshua's sacrifice, and unlike those who had already been martyred for the faith, struggling with sin, possibly not speaking of struggling with our own sin here, but referring back to facing opposition from sinners, still doesn't rise to the level of shedding one's blood. In other words, he's suggesting that however difficult his readers are finding it to follow and remain faithful to Yeshua, it's nothing compared to resisting the struggle to the point of literally dying for the faith. We need to persevere that much more now in order to be prepared to endure what may someday come. Then in verse 5, the author begins to explain how struggling and persevering through troubles and difficulty are part of how God disciplines and corrects and trains us for the building of our character and endurance. He reminds them of this by quoting from Proverbs chapter 3, calling it the exhortation that speaks fully with you as sons. So he's saying that this proverb directly applies to them because they're children of God. And the quote begins by saying to not despise the discipline of Adonai, nor give up being rebuked by him. So this part says that a son shouldn't despise his father's discipline, nor give up because of his father's rebuke, the implication being that discipline and rebuke from a father, from God, aren't things that are bad from which we should turn away. And in verse 6, he tells us why, finishing the quote from Proverbs, "For whom Adonai loves, he disciplines, and he punishes every son whom he receives." So discipline and punishment from God, and from any good father for that matter, comes from love. If God didn't love us and consider us his, he wouldn't care enough to pay attention to us and then discipline us when he determines we need it. And keep in mind, there are many different levels of discipline, anywhere from a stern word of correction to corporal punishment. Yet it's up to the father to determine exactly what we need so that we'll be more fully prepared to face the struggles of life with the right heart and mind. So what the author's saying here is not that every bad thing that happens to us is God disciplining us, or that our having faith in Yeshua is the cause for our punishment. All he's saying is that the punishment that results from our faith in Yeshua, the punishment that comes from the struggle of running that race and against the opposition of sinners, that punishment and rebuke is for our good, as would be God's correction for our personal sin. So it hurts, but it's instructive. It can be harsh, but it keeps us focused on the goal, Yeshua. That is, unless we despise that discipline and give up. The fact that we're made to face discipline, rebuke, and punishment for holding fast to our faith in Yeshua is evidence not just of God's correction and guidance for building our endurance, but of His love and our sonship. Continuing on, the author then further develops this concept and encouragement regarding how we should view the way God disciplines us. Verses 7 through 11. It is for discipline that you endure, for God behaves toward you as toward sons. Indeed, what son is there whom a father does not discipline? And if you are apart from discipline, of which all have become sharers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Then indeed, we have had fathers of our flesh disciplining us, and we were respecting them. Will we not much more be submitted to the Father of the Ruchot, the spirits, and live? For they indeed, the fathers of our flesh, for a few days, according to what seemed good to them, were disciplining. But He, God, disciplines us for our good, to be sharers of His separateness. And all discipline for the present time, indeed, does not seem to be of joy, but of grief. Yet afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those trained through it. So in verse 7, the author says that since God behaves toward us as toward sons, then that's why we need to endure and not despise the discipline. This isn't some purposeless punishment beating us up for no reason. It's coming from our Father. Indeed, as the author says, what son is there whom a father does not discipline? In other words, a father who doesn't discipline his son acts as if he has no son. So discipline from God is evidence of our being God's sons, which is essentially what he goes on to say in verse 8. If you are apart from discipline, if you aren't receiving discipline, then you are illegitimate and not sons. So he's saying this as an encouragement to those who are already, or may soon be, facing such discipline, namely in the form of persecution for their faith. He's telling them this so that they'll remember that when they are being persecuted, that it's because they're legitimate children of God. It's somewhat of a reverse encouragement. If you weren't being disciplined by God, then your being in Messiah would be fraudulent. But you are being disciplined, and the presence of that discipline indicates that you're truly part of the family of God. Then in verse 9, the author extends the metaphor even further by calling to mind the image of our earthly fathers and comparing it to God. He says that we have had fathers of our flesh disciplining us, and we were respecting them. In other words, all things being right and true, when our earthly fathers disciplined us, we respected them for it. So this being the case, will we not much more be submitted to the Father of the Ruchot and live? In other words, if we respected our earthly fathers for their discipline, should we not submit much more to our Heavenly Father? And he continues this train of thought in verse 10. For they indeed, for a few days, according to what seemed good to them, were disciplining. Our earthly fathers disciplined us while we were young, according to their best judgment of what we needed. But, the author says, He, meaning God, disciplines us for our good, to be sharers of His separateness. So the author appears to be implying that even with a father's best judgment, even if his intentions are for the good of his son, the discipline he dispenses may in some way not be what's best. Perhaps the discipline is overly harsh. Perhaps it's overly lenient. Either one, especially if repeated continually, wouldn't be good for the child. In comparison, then, the author appears to be implying that God's discipline is only ever for our good, no matter how harsh or lenient we may perceive it to be. And he disciplines us so that we can share in his separateness, so that we can be holy as he is. Then in verse 11, the author makes a general observation about discipline, while also clarifying its important role in our lives. He says that all discipline for the present time, indeed, does not seem to be of joy, but of grief. No one enjoys being disciplined, even when we know it's for our own good. Discipline often hurts and causes pain. Yet afterward, the author says, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those trained through it. In other words, discipline and correction, which grieves us in the moment, if we don't despise and resist it, will result in something peaceable and good, the fruit of righteousness. The discipline improves us, reorients us, and leads us into right ways of thinking and acting because it trains us to steer clear of unrighteousness and unbelief. So now that the author of Hebrews has reminded us about the good and loving work that God's discipline does in our lives in the midst of the struggle to live for Messiah, he now has some directives for us to get us moving in this correct direction. In verses 12 through 17, he adds, "Therefore, straighten up the hanging down hands and loosened knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that that which is lame may not be turned aside, but rather be healed. Pursue peace with all people, and also the separateness, apart from which no one will see the Master, diligently overseeing one another, so that no one will be failing to partake of the unmerited favor of God, so that no root of bitterness springing up may cause trouble, and many become defiled through it, and so that no one will be sexually immoral or a profane person, like Esau, who, in exchange for one morsel of food, sold his birthright. For you know that also afterwards, wanting to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found not a place of reformation, though having sought it with tears." So since God's discipline trains us in peace and righteousness, therefore, the author says in verse 12, straighten up the hanging down hands and loosen knees. Don't be exhausted and discouraged, but lift yourself up, stand up straight. And verse 13, probably still riffing on Proverbs, make straight paths for your feet so that that which is lame may not be turned aside, but rather be healed. Don't let the struggle of life in Messiah leave you feeling beat up and depressed, but lean into the discipline. Make straight paths for your feet, the feet that have been trained in righteousness, so that you don't continue to go astray in your lameness, but that you'll be healed and able to walk where God needs you to go. Then in verse 14, the author shows us how to start putting that training into practice in the ways we relate to others. Similar to his exhortation from chapter 10, to provoke one another to love and good actions, he says here to pursue peace with all people. The mere fact that he's telling us to do this implies that there are at least some with whom we have hostility. The author tells us that we need to overcome that. And he pairs this with also pursuing separateness, presumably meaning separateness from sin and the world, apart from which, he says, no one will see the Master. This statement begins the author's brief yet final return to his critical warning to not fall away from Yeshua, which he's brought up multiple times throughout this letter and discussed at length in chapters 6 and 10. So he's making here a very clear statement of fact that unless we walk in Messiah in the separateness, we will not see the Master. We will not find ourselves eternally in his presence. And this is why, in verse 15, he tells us to diligently oversee one another. He wants us to be involved in each other's lives, to not keep at arm's length, but to know one another and watch over each other so that we'll know when the others sinned and stumbled, and then be there to help confront it and lift them back up. He wants us to walk in that peace and separateness so that no one will be failing to partake of the unmerited favor of God. As followers of Messiah, we're supposed to be diligently overseeing each other so that we'll all succeed, not just in our daily walk of separateness in Messiah, but in being saved, in entering fully into the eternal Shabbat, seeing the Master, and partaking of God's unmerited favor. And he goes on to list even more benefits of this lateral oversight, saying that it'll also prevent from springing up among us and causing trouble and defilement, a root of bitterness. Presumably, since this appears to be an allusion to Deuteronomy 29:18, a root of bitterness against God. And also, verse 16, we need to diligently oversee one another so that no one will be sexually immoral or a profane person, meaning in this context, a worldly person, the opposite of someone who's separate from the world, but profanes himself by mixing with it. If we're accountable to one another, watching over each other, it'll be harder to fall into sexual immorality and worldly, unseparate living, and thereby keep us from seeing the Master. And as a witness to this kind of bitter and profane living, the author offers up the testimony of Esau, who sold his birthright to his brother Jacob in exchange for one morsel of food, as recorded in Genesis 25. The author uses Esau as an example of someone who was far more concerned with the things of the world, what to eat and drink, than with keeping covenant with God. And continuing his assessment of Esau in verse 17, he says that after selling his birthright and later wanting to inherit the blessing of his father Isaac, which had also been given to Jacob, Esau was rejected, not finding a place of reformation or repentance, though having sought it with tears. This commentary harkens back to chapter 6, where the author says that it's impossible for those who've fallen away from God to be renewed again to reformation. And also in chapter 10, he says that those who count the blood of the covenant as a common thing, a profane thing, are worthy of the worst punishment. So by using Esau's example here, the author's not only reiterating and emphasizing the danger and permanence of falling away from God, but he's demonstrating the catastrophic results when we fail to oversee and look out for one another. Esau despised his birthright and profaned the covenant of God. So when he had also lost the blessing, he was rejected and not given another chance. Though he tried to reform, it was too late. The blessing had already gone to another. So for our own sakes, we need to not be like Esau, wandering off in our own worldliness or forsaking our birthright in Messiah. But for the sake of both ourselves and our brothers and sisters in Yeshua, we need to be diligently overseeing one another so that we will all not be turned aside, but remain on the straight and separate path. So flowing from this clear and crucial directive, the author then invokes the awesome and awe-inspiring images of two mountains, representing and contrasting our two covenants, which the authors previously discussed, the Torah and the New Covenant. And he does this to reinforce why we can and must do this for one another. In verses 18 through 24, he says, "For you have not come near to what is being touched and scorched with fire, and to blackness and gloom and windstorm and a sound of a shofar and a voice of sayings, to which those having heard did appeal, so that the word might not be added to them, for they were not bearing that which was commanded, and if a beast touches the mountain, it must be stoned. And so terrible was the sight that Moshe said, I am exceedingly fearful and trembling. But you have come to Har Zion, and to a city of the living God, to the heavenly Jerusalem, and to tens of thousands of messengers, to the feast gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn enrolled in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to Ruchot of righteous men made perfect, and to a mediator of a fresh covenant, Yeshua, and to a blood of sprinkling that is speaking better things than that of Hevel. So as first mentioned in chapter 8, the author now returns again to Mount Sinai here in verse 18. We know this is talking about Mount Sinai from the detailed summary he gives of the events of Exodus 19 and 20, which includes fire and blackness and wind, the sound of a shofar, the voice of God, and the people begging to not hear it, since it was so frightening. And when the people arrived at the mountain, they were also told to not let anything go near it because the mountain was holy. And in verse 21, the author says that the sight was so terrible, as in terrifying, that even Moses was fearful and trembling. So going back to verse 18, the author says that to this mountain and this scene, his readers have not come near. He's once again using the historical experiences of Israel to communicate his message. Our ancestors experienced all this at the foot of Mount Sinai. But this is not the mountain you've come near to, where the people were forbidden to go up on the mountain and were afraid to approach God in his awesomeness and holiness. This is how Israel used to relate to God, through the Torah, especially the priesthood, which formed an intermediary barrier between the people and God. But you, the author says in verse 22, have come to Har Zion, to Mount Zion. And on this mountain, and under a new covenant, things are different. Once again, the author paints a picture. The second mountain is a heavenly one, home to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to tens of thousands of messengers. Unlike ancient Israel, the author's readers, and by extension all believers in Yeshua, have come to the feast gathering, the assembly of the firstborn enrolled in heaven, to God himself, who is judge of all, and to the spirits of righteous men made perfect. And we come to all this, verse 24, because we've come to and through the mediator of a fresh covenant, Yeshua, whose blood speaks such tremendously better things than the whole entire cloud of witnesses, beginning with the faith of righteous Abel, as he did in chapter 11. So what the author's saying with this comparison of the two mountains and two covenants is that we can and must diligently oversee one another to help bring each other along so that none of us may permanently fall away, but that we may all see the Master together. Not because you've stood at the foot of Moses' holy mountain, which you weren't allowed to touch, which induced fear because of the awesomeness and holiness of God, and which had a priesthood that kept us at a distance from the holy places, but because of the better things spoken through the blood of the Messiah, who mediates a fresh covenant with a better priesthood, which has initiated a new and living way for us to boldly approach the entrance into the most holy place and the presence of our awesome and holy God. What an incredible picture. And finally, finishing his comparison with Moses, the author brings his whole letter full circle, concluding his main message with a word of somber warning. In verses 25 through 29, he exhorts us, "See that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if those having refused him who was divinely speaking upon earth did not escape, how much less will we who turn away from him who speaks from heaven? Him whose voice shook the earth at that time, but now he has promised, saying, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heaven. And this yet once more makes clear that the removal of the things shaken is as of things having been made, so that the things not shaken may remain. Therefore, receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, may we have unmerited favor through which we may serve God well-pleasingly, with reverence and awe, for also our God is a consuming fire. So following verse 24, where the author says that the blood of Yeshua is speaking better things, verse 25 begins with the author's admonition to see that you do not refuse him who is speaking. So the one speaking who we must not refuse appears to be Yeshua, or perhaps God more broadly. But in any case, this summary thought here at the end of chapter 12 harkens all the way back to the opening verses of Hebrews, where he says that in these last days, God spoke to us in a son. So the one who's speaking, who we must not refuse, is the one who's revealing the glory and superiority of the Master Yeshua, the confidence we can have in wholeheartedly following him, and the fatal mistake we as believers can make if we fall away. He goes on to say, "For if those having refused him who was divinely speaking upon the earth did not escape," that is, escape God's judgment, think back to chapter 3 where the author spoke about how Israel provoked God and died in the desert, "how much less will we escape who turn away from him who speaks from heaven?" In other words, God came down to earth upon Mount Sinai. He spoke to Moses from above the ark cover, yet the people ultimately refused the word which was brought through God's messenger and as a result didn't escape his judgment. Therefore, if Israel couldn't escape, if the ancient people of God, whose covenant could bring them only so near to God's holiness, couldn't escape judgment, then how much less of a chance do we as believers in Messiah have, we who have a new and living way into the most holy place, what chance do we have to escape when we turn away from the one who speaks to us from heaven? Now, that's quite a sobering thought. And he goes on in verse 26 to drive this point home and wrap everything up by making it clear what we're all eventually facing. He says that God, whose voice shook the earth at that time, referring to the time of the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, that he's promised in Haggai 2:6 that yet once more he will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. In other words, he promises to shake all of creation, everything that's been made. And in verse 27, the author explains the significance of this. He says that by God promising this yet once more, this second shaking when the whole universe is shaken, he makes it clear that the things of creation that are shaken loose by the shaking will be removed, yet the things that cannot be shaken will remain. So for those of us as believers in Yeshua who refuse him who is speaking, who fall away and into the hands of the living God, who are not diligent to hold fast to the faith and enter into God's stopping place, we will be shaken loose and not escape his judgment and reckoning. But for those of us who do accept his word, who do not despise his discipline, who endure the struggle, who submit to God, who make straight paths for our feet and do not turn aside, but hold fast to Yeshua, we will not be shaken, but will live. Therefore, the author says in verse 28, since we who do this are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, may we have unmerited favor through which we may serve God well-pleasingly with reverence and awe. Because our God, who gave us his Son and made a new and living way to enter into his unshakable kingdom, is not a God to be taken lightly. Instead, we must take deathly seriously our birthright and inheritance as children of God through the Messiah Yeshua, because our loving God, who also disciplines us as sons and shakes the universe, is also a consuming fire. And with that, the author concludes the heart of his message. The 12th chapter of the book of Hebrews is the author's candid, straightforward and blunt conclusion to his already sobering and powerful exhortation, telling us to hold fast to our faith in Yeshua. Before ending his letter completely with the various matters of chapter 13, which we'll be covering in the next episode, the author wraps up his main message here, not with feel-good, self-help words of contentment and comfort, but with bold admonishments about facing reality and avoiding the unbelief that can lead to our falling away. But what the author does not withhold from us is the motivation that comes from seeing Yeshua's example and fixing our eyes on him as the author and perfecter of faith. As Yeshua himself experienced, the goal of our faith isn't achieved without the agonizing struggles to get there. And though they can often be times of great grief and pain, they're ultimately for the building of our endurance, so that we'll be ready to finish our race and be trained to oversee and help others to succeed in theirs. The discipline of God can be excruciating, yet it teaches and guides us as long as we don't despise it and give up. Because all discipline from God is good and proves to us that our Father in heaven truly loves us and considers us to be his. Now is not the time to fall away through unbelief, but to put off every weight and the closely surrounding sin. Keep your strength up. Be prepared to endure what lies ahead. Push through and persevere, letting others look out for you as you look out for them. So make straight paths for your feet, so that that which is lame may not be turned aside, but rather be healed. For you have come to Har Zion, to the new and better mountain, where if you remain diligent to hold fast to your faith, you will not be shaken, but brought to see the Master. Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Biblically Correct Podcast. If you like this episode and want to see us make more, then we need your help. Visit our website at biblicallycorrectpodcast.org to support the work of Perfect Word Ministries and MJMI through your much-needed donations. And of course, don't forget to rate, review, share, follow, or subscribe to the podcast to receive notifications whenever a new episode is posted. If you have any questions about this teaching, or if there are any other topics you'd like to see me cover, shoot me an email at kevin@perfectword.org. That's kevin@perfectword.org. Until next time, remember that every scripture is God-breathed and profitable for teaching, for refuting, for setting aright, and for instruction that is in righteousness, so that the man of God may be fully equipped, having been completed for every good act. Shalom.